So last time, we finished up talking about vector instructions. So we mentioned that there are some issues with vector instructions that we didn't deal with well, like conditionals or loading and storing non-contiguous values. There are ways hardware can help out with that that we didn't go over. Just want to be aware. I'm not going to talk about exactly how they work. Also, we mentioned that there's other ways of programming vector instructions besides like writing that assembly and writing those intrinsic functions or relying on the compiler to just figure it out. And these are actually in pretty common use, especially with GPUs. Let me talk just sort of generally about optimization. One of the big things is that you want to optimize what matters. So in a big program, you're not going to know that this rotate function is what I need to optimize. So you should use a profiler rather than guessing, because it turns out that programmers frequently guess incorrectly about what part of their program is slow. Then we talked about a completely different topic, about sort of hardware support for things that operating systems do. We mentioned one sort of abstraction that's usually the main point of having an operating system, which is this idea of a process, where we'd have these threads, which is that the program is written as if it has a dedicated core. That you act as if you own the whole CPU, you can like write an infinite loop, and that's not a problem. And typically the way that we implement this abstraction is via time multiplexing, that the operating system will share over time a single core between multiple programs. And we also have the illusion of a dedicated memory, which we call an address space. And this means that I can write my program as if I can use any memory address, and that if I write to a random memory address, well, that's just going to be my problem. It's not going to be some other program's problem. And this is typically implemented via address translation, meaning that we have this mapping from the addresses the program sees to real addresses, or more specifically, via a specific kind of address translation called virtual memory that we're going to talk about as our next topic after exceptions. And part of implementing time multiplexing was this idea of context switches, so that we have what we call the context, which is the state of a program that's visible, so like the registers it can use, what address space is active, and things like condition codes. So like you might not think of that as being sort of inherently visible, but if we don't save and restore that, the program's going to behave incorrectly. So it's visible in that sense, that it changes the program's behavior. And this is information that the OS needs to save when it switches away from a program and restore when it switches back to one. Now, if we know what the OS is saving and restoring, we still need to understand sort of how the OS gets to run. And our hardware mechanism for this is what we called exceptions. We mentioned that these are not the exceptions you learned in Java or C++. This is a different thing, even though there's some similarities. And this is a mechanism by which the processor gives the OS control, even though we don't have something like a call or a jump instruction to run the OS. And we have lots of different reasons the processor might want to give the OS control. We have some which we called asynchronous, where there's some event external to the program. The program was just minding its own business, and the processor decided, okay, well, just I should run the OS now. This could be for like a timer that the OS would typically set up, or for some I/O event, something comes in on the network, someone presses a key, something like that. The OS needs to handle that regardless of what was running now. We also have synchronous exceptions, ones which are triggered by something the program does. So sometimes this would be triggered by something that the program deliberately did, and we call these traps. And the typical kind of trap was a system call, where the program was trying to make a request to the OS to do something on its behalf. And we saw one example of a system call you might want to make is to ask the OS to please give me keyboard input next time you get some. This also occurs for things that might be a little less intentional by the program, like if the program executes an invalid instruction, accesses memory that has no mapping, and things like that. That's going to also run the OS, because the processor doesn't know what to do in that case, so the processor is going to ask the OS to figure out what to do. typically we see OSs, I guess maybe not typically, but most visibly we see OSs deciding, oh, let's crash the program or run the debugger when that event happens. And we also mentioned, for giving the OS control, we had to say, where does it, we give the OS control, and we had this notion of an exception table, which is just an array of pointers to exception handlers, the code that the OS wants to run. So these handler functions. And those handler functions are what the code that the OS told the processor to run, typically by configuring this at boot. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
To open up terminal and type list, is it async or sync?
So if I open up the terminal and type ls, yes. You're asking, is that a, like what exceptions are involved there?
Yes.
So you, I think you asked the question as if there was one, but there probably is more than, a lot more than one. Right? So if we think of opening up the terminal typing ls, we have a bunch of exceptions happening to inform the OS that there's input from the keyboard that it needs to put somewhere. We have some exceptions probably happening for the shell, the program that runs other programs, to receive that input and figure out what to do with it. We have another exception probably happening where that program requests the OS run the ls program. Then when the ls program is running, it probably makes a bunch of system calls to ask the OS to please read something from disk for it. And also some system calls to ask the OS to please write something to the terminal so the user can see it. So there's a whole lot of exceptions that are just probably just necessary parts of that, in addition to other exceptions which might be happening, like timers going off or unrelated I/O happening on the machine, like if something comes into the network while LS is printing out, and that's going to also be exceptions. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So explain again, how does time multiplexing allow the illusion of the dedicated core? Like, it doesn't actually allow multiplexing?
So question, how does time multiplexing allow the illusion of dedicated core? So we saw that the illusion was broken when we looked at how long things took. Is that was your complaint?
Yeah.
So the illusion of the dedicated core does not include anything about how that core performs. So it just is that it executes instructions in order without your register values getting clobbered by something else running and so on. So it includes nothing about that it executes an add instruction consistently in one cycle. So if that's our model of what a core is, that we don't have any guarantees in how fast instructions are, and we kind of make sense not to, because if you think of cache misses, right, we kind of really don't have that in the first place, then time multiplexing still provides that. Like, from the perspective of the program, all time multiplexing does is it sometimes makes instructions, take an extra time. But the functionality of the core otherwise is unchanged. But it's true that this is not a perfect illusion. Does that answer your question? Yes. So, okay, so your question is that on our list of types of exceptions, we have this weird category known as aborts, which I did classify as asynchronous. So this is something I'm not going to talk about much because they don't come up very often. They're important if you're writing an OS. But sort of a classic example of this is that some memory can tell that it's broken, that it can't store values that it's trying to store a value and that value got corrupted. That would be an example of an abort. So in that case, we want to ask the OS, what do you want to do about this? Often the thing to do about it would be to try to save everything to disk and display an error message. But that's something that the hardware does need to handle because those sorts of things happen. That hardware will self-detect that something's broken and probably you can't proceed. And the OS, you want to run the OS to see if the OS can do some sort of recovery from that. Usually at least enough to save whatever's running, or only kill off the process that's affected if it's like a part of memory's not working anymore, and so on. Does that answer your question? Yeah. But I deliberately don't spend much time talking about aborts because they don't come up much as someone who, unless you're programming an OS, and even when you're doing that, typically the handling is basically that you run your the OS crashed function when an abort happens. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So last time we were talking about how we had our infinite loop. And the reason why that didn't actually hog the core forever, so we had a timer interrupt, we looked up in the exception table, the OS's timer interrupt handler, and the OS's timer interrupt handler ended up switching to another program. That we ran that handler, and when it returned, it restored the registers and the address space of something else, in this example, SSH. And you might say, well, this is just code here. And what's stopping me, as the author of loop.exe, from fixing this problem where I don't actually get the whole core by writing my own exception handler? I have a much better exception handler as far as running loop well here, where I just return from the timer interrupt handler without doing anything. Seems like a good idea. It seems like I can just set the exception table base pointer to set that up. So what's going to stop that? And, well, we can try this. So I wrote a program that did this for x86. So in x86, the instruction to set the exception table base pointer is called LIDT for load interrupt descriptor table. But we'll get into why they call them interrupts later. And, I did this with a properly set up exception table. I run this, and to my terminal prints out segmentation fault. So apparently, running the instruction to set an exception table caused an exception instead of actually setting the exception table. And it caused an exception that ran the normal exception handlers in the OS. So what's going on here? Why can't I actually do this? And this is what we call a privileged instruction. So there are some instructions that we're only going to allow the OS to do. And when normal code tries to do it, we're going to want to disallow it. And there's a whole bunch of instructions like this. So setting the exception table is one example. I can't let any program do that because then they could break time multiplexing. Either on purpose, like that example, or by accident, if they commonly try to use this functionality for something else. I can't allow them to set the address space, because then they could corrupt the values in another program's memory, or corrupt the OS's memory, and that's not something we want if we want to think of a machine like Portal, which is shared between multiple users. We don't want it to be the case that, like, if your copy of Emacs has a bug, that it breaks someone else's copy of Emacs. But that would be something which could happen if we have this set address space call be something that the OS can't control tightly. We typically make the decision that talking to an I/O device is something that's always going to be done by the OS. So we'll make that a privileged instruction. So if a program wants to talk to an I/O device, that's going to be something that it can't do directly. It's going to have to ask the OS for help. So to implement this idea that some of these instructions are going to be only allowed for the OS, the processor is going to have two modes. We're going to have kernel mode, where the privileged instructions work, and user mode, where instead of doing the intended operation, they trigger an exception and tell the OS, hey, this program tried to set the exception table or talk directly to an I/O device. You decide what to do. So, question? Question, what does setting the exception table mean? So remember when we talked about, I don't have the slide here. So when we talked about we had this exception table base pointer, this special register, and it pointed to the array of exception handlers. And this like pointed to like handle div by zero, for example, right? We have this array of exception handlers. So I mean setting this register here, so that would change what all the exception handlers are. Does that answer your question? Yes. So question, if I were to change the exception table base pointer, would I point to a new set of functions? Presumably yes. So setting the exception table is an example of an operation which, well, it's kind of unusual to do, because typically the way operating systems are written is that we'll basically do this once at boot, and then we're done. Other questions? Okay, so we have these two modes, user mode and kernel mode, and one question might be, how do we run the OS code in kernel mode and not everything else in kernel mode? And how do we actually switch into kernel mode? Because, you know, I don't want it to be the case that once I start running a program, I can't do any I/O. Like, I want to be able to like print something to the screen, but I don't want it to be the case that any program can just decide to turn on kernel mode, because then if I go back to here, you know, I don't want it to be the case that like there's just a run in kernel mode instruction I can add here. You know, that shouldn't be a thing, right? I shouldn't have that option. The OS should have to like give me permission to do that somehow. And the basic way we're going to decide what code runs in kernel mode and what doesn't, so, well, the processor is going to have to track kernel mode, so we'll have like a one-bit register, which is, are we in kernel mode or are we not? And generally, exceptions are going to enter kernel mode. And I mentioned earlier that we're going to have a special return from exception instruction. And here's the reason why we definitely need a special instruction. So the return from exception instruction is going to leave kernel mode. So it's going to restore the old normal user mode. So this means our exception handlers that are written by the OS get to run in kernel mode, but all the other code won't. Yes? So the question is, if we have multiple exceptions, do we enter kernel mode and then leave? So if the exceptions happen one, if we handle one exception, return from it, and handle the next exception, yes. We can also have nested exceptions. In that case, we would enter kernel mode and stay in kernel mode during the nesting, typically. So by nested exceptions, I mean like we could have a system call, and during the system call, we have like a key press happen. In which case, we'd have two exception handlers running within each other. Yes? Sorry?
Is this the same as try something and then accept?
Is this the same as try and accept in Python? So as I mentioned earlier, these are hardware exceptions. They are not the exceptions you see in Java, C++, or any other programming language. There's a relationship in that they're both ways we handle errors that programs do, but that's about it. Like, the way they're implemented is very different. Other questions? Yes? Question, are there ways to enter kernel mode besides having an exception happen? That depends on the machine, but usually, essentially, no. Question? So the question, is there's a register that checks if we're in kernel mode? Yes, so there's going to be something like a condition code register that's for kernel mode or not. And as for checking whether we enter it, so part of the jump for an exception is going to set the kernel mode register to 1. And you know, if necessary, maybe remember that we were previously in user mode. And part of the return from exception is going to restore the old user kernel mode value. Question? So question, exceptions in enter kernel mode just mean that if we're not in kernel mode, we set it? Yes. So basically, exceptions enter kernel mode means we set that bit to 1. That's what the hardware has to do, and the instructions that are privileged, like set address space, are going to check that bit before they actually do the operation. Other questions? So this includes questions. This includes synchronous and asynchronous exceptions? Yes. So another thing you might wonder about is, you know, I told you we can't like set a new exception table, but maybe if we just overwrite the exception table, like what's going to stop us from doing that? And you might say, okay, well, you mentioned you had this address space mapping, so maybe the exception table is just not in that mapping. And that sounds like a great idea, and there's some architectures which support that, but it's actually pretty common that the exception table lookup will use the mapping. And this is in fact true in x86, generally. So you might say, wait a moment, that means that the exception table is in the memory. Like it has an address that I can specify in my program that will map to the real address of the exception table, what's going to stop me from overwriting it? And we've kind of actually seen this on our diagrams of typical program layout. I had this region labeled used by OS. And that's the sort of region where the OS would typically put the exception table if it has to have an address that's one of the pre-mapping addresses. But you notice I've sort of shaded this out as if it's inaccessible. So how is it used by the OS and inaccessible? And the answer here is that to help support the operating system having things in memory without changing that mapping, we're going to have an option where we can specify, in addition to mapping to an address or an error, we could specify that some part of program A and program B's memory maps to an address, but only works in kernel mode. And the processor will make it the case that if you try to access that address in user mode, it will trigger an exception, just as if you accessed an invalid address that's never works. And most operating systems take a design where they take some part of the address space assigned to each program and map it this way, usually the same way in every single program, for the OS to have some space to use. Like there are other, you don't have to do this if you're writing an OS, but this is the most common design that OSs have chosen. And the hardware has support to help OSs do this. Yes?
So every program has its own mapping to the.
So the question is, every program is going to have its own mapping to the exception table? Yes, and typically a lot of other OS data structures, like all the save contexts and so on. Yes? Can I explain this diagram? So by program A addresses, I mean any address we use in program A. So if we jump to 0x12345, 12345 is going to be interpreted by using this function here. If we load from 12345, same thing. We're going to interpret that 12345 by using this function here. And this can map to normal addresses. So this would be real addresses. Or it can map to, say, the processor is going to say, sorry, couldn't look anything up, and is going to tell the OS, hey, there was a problem. And we also have this additional option that it can map to a normal address, but that mapping will only work if the processor is in kernel mode. And if it's not, it's going to do the same thing it would do if the address wasn't mapped at all. Question? The question is, in this diagram, this OS data block seems to be shared between program A and program B. Is that actually typical? Yes. So most OSs will do that. There's no requirement to work that way, but that's the most common operating system software design. Yes? Question, what do I mean by illusion of its own memory? So all from program A's perspective, when it's running in user mode, it has some memory that's dedicated to itself, and those are the only addresses it can access because it can only put in things on this end of the mapping. And that memory is distinct and independent of every other program, including program B. Does that answer your question? So the question, if program A and program B both access the same numerical address, those would be mapped to different places? Yeah. According to this diagram, yes, unless it was part of the OS's data. But in that case, that would only work if they were in an exception handler, like a system call. Yes. So question, what if one program wants to access another program's memory? So an example of this might be a debugger. And in that case, to set that up, the debugger is going to typically make a system call to ask the OS, say, please let me set up access to this other program's memory. And either one way that could work is that the OS could change this mapping so there's overlap deliberately. That's a common thing. Or the OS could give you a system call where the OS would, on your behalf, access the other program's memory. And return the value it got. Other questions? Okay. So this event where a program tries to access something that it's not allowed to, either running an instruction it's not allowed to or accessing memory that's reserved for the OS, these are typically called protection faults. We call sort of keeping the program from doing things that the OS is only supposed to do sort of protection, broadly speaking. For memory, we call it memory protection. And that's our examples of this kernel mode idea. So we talked about what sort of things are privileged. So let's see what we think about that. So here's a bunch of things that the question is, which of these could we do directly in user mode? So you could probably do all of them by making a system call, asking the OS to do it on our behalf. Which of them could we do without a system call? Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so let's see. So who thinks A would fail? Reading data on the disk with special instructions, okay. B, changing the address space to allocate more memory. C, returning from a standard library function. Okay, a couple. And D, incrementing the stack pointer. Okay, so that matches the majority answers are A and B, and that's exactly my understanding here. So there's some confusion with returning from a standard library function and incrementing the stack pointer. So one thing, standard library functions, a lot of them are going to need help from the OS. Like if we think of like printf, like to actually put something on the screen, it's going to need help from the OS, but that's going to be part of the code within printf. It's not actually returning from that. You know, so that work is going to be done before printf returns. Incrementing the stack pointer sometimes is confusing because you think of like changing the stack pointer as allocating and deallocating memory. But generally, well, there's two things that go on. So one is, as we'll learn, as we've seen, like we have some space allocated for the stack kind of when the program starts. And the stack pointer is just changing how much of that we have in use. Another thing is we'll learn later that yes, OSs do allocate and deallocate stack space kind of as you use it sometimes, but that's not going to be done by changing how incrementing the stack pointer works. There's going to be some other mechanism for that. We'll talk about probably next week or the week after. Yes? What question, why C doesn't work? So our standard library function, like printf. So printf, yes, it needs to put something on the screen, but basically, the way that's going to work is that printf is going to be a normal function, which is going to do stuff, you know, possibly make a system call, and then do stuff. And the return is the same as a return from, like, a Fibonacci function. So, yes, there's some stuff that requires, you know, kernel mode in there, but that's not the returning part. It's just something in the middle that sometimes uses kernel mode. And it uses kernel mode by making a system call, as we'll talk about next. Yes?
Does superuser do enter kernel mode?
Sorry?
Does sudo enter kernel mode?
So, a question is that you've heard of sudo or root or administrator. Are those kernel mode? No. So, what sudo, root, administrator are ways where the OS tracks what your process is allowed to do and those just change what the OS will allow you to do from system calls. So a system call, you know, like, you know, reboot the machine is going to check, are you allowed to do this? And that changes that sort of decision. So it is not running code in kernel mode. Your normal programs that are not part of the OS do not run code in kernel mode. You know, on a typical OS, not ever, with absolutely no exceptions. Yes? Sorry? Can I explain D? So incrementing the stack pointer. Stack pointer is just a register. So it's the same as like incrementing RAX. So it's just a register. We do save it when we switch away from programs, but we also save, you know, every other register that might store a temporary value. It's true that the stack pointer determines what memory we're using, but that's separate from what memory the OS has set up in the mapping. And if there's going to be a change to that, it's not going to happen because we change the stack pointer. It's going to happen because we make a system call or because we do something else that would normally trigger an exception, like accessing memory that isn't mapped yet. Other questions? Okay. So we have all these kernel services allocating memory, reading or writing files, reading input that need privileged instructions, And we mentioned earlier that, well, we have to ask the OS for help. We're going to do this with a trap, a deliberately triggered exception, known as a system call. And I'll show how these work on 64-bit x86 Linux. So on 64-bit x86 Linux, the hardware has provided for us a special instruction called syscall. The only purpose of this instruction is to trigger an exception. That's all it does. And basically, syscall we're going to use in Linux like a normal function call. And there's going to be a calling convention that Linux has chosen for how its system calls work. This is Linux's choice. It's not determined by the hardware. And Linux chose that we're going to pass the arguments in the same way we pass arguments to a normal function, because that was just convenient. And we have to specify what operation we want to do. And Linux decided that we're going to use RAX to specify that, which was just an easy choice because we know RAX is going to be used for the return value. And we need to put that information somewhere because it's just syscall, it's not syscall something. So we have to have the extra information on, like, are we, like, reading from something? Are we, you know, allocating memory? We have to know that. And they decided to put that information there. And the other part of the calling convention is we have to return the result. Linux decided that we're going to return that in REX, just like a normal function call. And for errors, we're going to put a negative number there by convention. So Linux chose, just to make things convenient, that this looks like a normal function call. But what happens is we execute the syscall instruction. It runs the OS. The OS handler finishes. And then it returns from that exception to after the syscall function. So the way that this might be used is, so here's a program that uses system calls on Linux directly to write hello world and accent instead of using any library functions. And this program starts at underscore start and dot main, because when you're using main in C, that's actually something that's called by the standard library. So this is a program that doesn't need a standard library, because normally the standard library functions like printf are going to contain the calls that actually write stuff, the system calls that write stuff. Here, we're not relying on that. So you can see here that I needed to specify which operation I'm doing with RAX, as I mentioned. So one is the number that Linux arbitrarily signed for the write operation. And the arguments for that are, where do I want to write to? One indicates standard out. What I want to write, so I have my string and the length of that string. And I make a system call, and that writes. Then I want to exit. You might say, can't I just return? What am I going to return to? So in your typical program, when you return from main, you're actually returning to standard library code. But here, I don't have standard library code to return to. And after I finish running my hello world, I want to stop this program and run something else. That is not something that I can do, because I don't have access to other programs. That's the OS's responsibility. That's not in my address space. I can't, like, read their contexts. Can't switch to them directly. So I need to ask the OS for help. Hey, OS, please stop me and run something else. And so we have a system call for that called exit, which happens to have number 60. It takes an argument, which is the same thing as the return value for main. So typically, we return 0. And that's how I exit and tell the OS, stop this program, run something else. If I just returned, well, that would read something from the stack and try to jump there, which would probably be a seg fault. So questions about my direct system call hello world program? Yes? So question, what happens if I don't include that? So you mean, like, in Y86, we didn't have that. So in Y86, we have the special hold instruction that we ran. And the sort of notion was that we were running without an OS, right? So the reason why we have something interesting to do when we're done here, rather than just halting the machine, is because there's other programs to run on the same machine. And that's like the difference between sort of our HTLR simulated environment and a real machine is that, you know, real machines share. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So
So where does it print hello world? So this is equivalent to, this is right hello world here to file descriptor one. So it's done at this syscall here is where that print will happen. Yes?
So this syscall is a table or something?
So the question is, does the implementation of the exception handler for a system call use a table? Typically, yes. On Linux, it does. There's no hardware requirement to do that. Because as far as the hardware is concerned, it's just running the handle system call exception handler, and it doesn't care what it does. In the case of Linux, what that handler is going to do is it's going to save a bunch of stuff and do a table lookup. But you could implement this in any way you want if you're writing an OS. Other questions? I saw something over here, but there's not. Yeah.
So can any program use syscall?
Can any program use syscall? So on 64-bit x86 Linux? Yes, and we'll typically use it a lot. Because you have to use syscall or something very like it to write anything to the screen, read any input, read from a file, you know, open a file, etc. Yes. So using a syscall like this would be an example of a trap? Yeah, so syscall is always a trap instruction. It always causes a trap. That's the only thing the instruction can usefully do. So if you see it, that's what's happening. Other questions? Yeah?
Are there ways to cause a trap without syscall?
Question, are there ways to cause a trap without syscall? So there were other instructions that trigger a trap on in x86 for things like system calls. So there's a, so syscall is like not the first x86 system call instruction. So there's other things you might see if you're looking at OS code, especially stuff that dates back to 32-bit x86. So also there's some traps which aren't intended for system calls. So for example, when you see things compiled, you'll sometimes see this instruction, UD2. Which is stands for undefined number 2, I guess. And it's an instruction which triggers an illegal instruction exception. That's all it's for. And the reason that compilers generate it is that, like, if you have, like, an if statement which would divide by 0, the compiler wants to generate code for the divide by 0, commonly will generate just a trigger an illegal instruction to stop the program because something went wrong. And that's sort of that's what that instruction exists for. So you have instructions like that that are traps. You also have, so this is like something went wrong. You also have like, there's an int1, which is a debugger breakpoint on x86. And other platforms have their own versions of this. And this is an instruction which is a trap which exists to run the debugger for me, please. So that would be an example of another type of trap. But these are pretty uncommon to run. So like the traps that you'll see almost all the time are a system call instruction or something that is basically doing the same thing. So UD2 is, you know, error shouldn't have reached. That's something compilers will generate for that. Yeah. So the question, if I called printf instead of using a syscall, would this sort of thing be happening in printf? Yes. So printf is going to have code something like this, obviously a little more dynamic, to actually write stuff to the terminal. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's how our system call looks from the user side. In the kernel side, typically we'll have a handler that like saves a bunch of registers and does a table lookup because we've chosen to have RAX tell us which system call to have. This is, again, just how Linux has sort of chosen to do things, but you could do something else if you wanted. Like you could have the system call numbers not be like zero based or whatever, because the hardware doesn't care from the hardware's perspective. All it's doing is jumping to here in kernel mode. That's all the hardware needs to implement. Yes? So the question is, why is there an 8 here? That's because each of these pointers are 8-byte pointers. So it's just to skip by the right number of pointers. So if RAX was 1, it would reach the handle write syscall, yes. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What is the star before sys?
What is the star? When you're calling something, it indicates that we're reading a pointer from the table, that the table doesn't actually contain the code. Okay. Other questions? So I showed you that Linux has this write and exit system call. There's a few others out there. So there's like system calls to allocate memory. There's system calls to create new processes, because you can't do that yourself. That's because the OS manages the list of processes. There's system calls to run a different program, which handles like loading the program from disk, and to read and write files, and so on. Now, if you look at this assembly, and you've done low-level Linux programming before, you might be confused, because you might have said, oh, I made system calls in my C code before, and you didn't really. You made calls to system call wrappers. So commonly, we'll have a function whose only purpose is to make a system call, just so we can conveniently like call one of these system calls from C. So for example, we can write open something in C rather than writing assembly. So there's going to be, in this standard library, there are a bunch of functions which are, you know, not like printf, where like printf does a bunch of work and then, you know, writes things. Functions who all they do is just, you know, set for on Linux would set RAX and make a syscall. You know, make that syscall instruction. They don't do any processing, and they exist solely so from C, I can write a function call and have it make a system call without writing assembly. Okay, some questions about system call wrappers? Okay, so we learned a bunch about system calls and exceptions. Let's do sort of where do exceptions happen. So which of these, I'm not asking about system calls, I'm asking about exceptions. So which of these operations involve some sort of exception, and which of them involve some sort of context switch? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, that's good people. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with which of these require exceptions. So who thinks A? Okay, couple. B, majority. C, okay. D, okay. E, and F. Okay, and which of these require context switches? Who thinks A? B? C? Okay, D? Okay, E? Okay, F. Okay, so let's start with requiring exceptions. I think we had this. We had pretty good agreement that for exceptions, we had that B, C, D all required one. And I think the others do not. I think there's a little bit of confusion on A. So some standard library calls are going to trigger an exception. So like if we went to print something through the screen, we're going to do that. Many aren't. So I would say it doesn't require it because, well, it depends on the standard library call whether it's going to need to do one. But there's plenty which don't, which definitely don't, like say stringlen or sprintf. You know, so, or like pow, all those sorts of things. There's lots of things you call in the standard library which have absolutely no reason to carry an exception. It's just a function call. Remember that linking happens, so the standard library is just a normal thing you call. And calling a normal function and returning from a normal function also shouldn't require an exception because, you know, it's just changing registers and the stack pointer. And those are parts of our context that we can have full access to because, well, we have this thread idea, this illusion we have a dedicated CPU, so we from a programmer's perspective, think we have full control over that, even though it's really being shared with others. Question?
I thought by calling, it just meant the call instruction in assembly and not whatever.
Yeah, so question, you thought by calling, we meant the call instruction in assembly, and the call instruction in assembly shouldn't ever trigger an exception? You are correct. I know some people interpret that as the whole function call from beginning to end. Yes?
So if this were a question on a quiz, would you specify that the call meant like the whole call?
If this were a question on a quiz, would I specify the call that meant the whole call? I don't think that's necessary for this because of the word require. You know, which should indicate which of these should always have an exception. And clearly, even if you include the whole thing, it shouldn't always because there are lots of standard library functions we use which should not need any exception, regardless. Yes? So if it said the program calls printf, I probably need to be more specific because of this printf call. Because it doesn't print anything. But, and I also need to be more specific because of buffering. If you remember buffering, which I think we go over in 2150 at some point, maybe. You know how you have to sometimes like use fflush? Nope, okay. We used to cover that sometimes in 2150. So printf sometimes doesn't print immediately. Is another thing, so. So question is, should I interpret call as the call instruction of the whole function? We will clarify that if it changes the answer. And if we forget to, well, on an exam or a quiz, you have a place you can write comments. And you should do so if you think it's ambiguous. Okay. So then on context switches. So we had pretty good consensus that C and D required context switches. We had some confusion about whether E was a context switch. And I think that's from, well, when we call functions, like we save registers and restore registers. So a context switch means everything that's in the context is being saved and restored. So we generally don't think of the sort of limited save and restore we do for function calls as a context switch. A context switch is when we're saving sort of everything that makes up what's on the processor. Like all those registers, at least. Yes?
So why don't we have a context switch for B?
So question, why don't we have a context switch for B? So assuming that we just do the write in the exception handler and then return from the exception handler, it's true that we're saving the context to run the exception handler most likely and then restoring it, but we aren't switching to another one. Yeah. So the question, the OS doesn't have its own context that we're switching to. So some OSs are designed in that way. So some OSs, the way system calls would work is that they'll switch to an OS context and then switch back. That's not the most common design. Most commonly, the way system calls work is that they'll save the stuff that the program was using, do some OS stuff with a fresh sort of new context. So the saving will kind of look more like what you save for a function call, though it will be more complete than that typically for a even for a system call. And then they'll return back restoring that same context. But they won't like switch to an existing set of registers. They'll just start anew. That's not the only OS design. So there are OSs which will do a real context switch to a special OS thread, but that is not the most common design. Other questions? Okay. So, on terminology. So, you may have noticed that when I showed this slide, I showed like all these names for exceptions, and you might have been surprised that I have like actually spent very little time on vocabulary, like which is an interrupt, which is a trap, sort of stuff. And the reason for that is that I don't think that's useful because the real world has very inconsistent about what terms to use for exceptions. So our textbook has a particular taxonomy, and I've tried to stick with our textbook's taxonomy. But if you pick up a random processor manual, you'll get some other set of terms most likely. And lots of different possibilities exist in the real world, and there's a big lack of agreement between what the names are, you know, even among different popular architectures. Like the x86 manuals and the ARM manuals use different terms for, you know, and same is true for all the sort of other architectures. So you might see interrupt referring to, like our textbook does, or in our textbook, interrupts are just those externally triggered events that aren't errors. And if you pick up the x86 manual, interrupts are every type of exception is an interrupt, is some kind of interrupt. You might see exception referring to all types of exceptions, like our textbook does. Or you might see it being a term just for faults, those exceptions which are triggered by some weird event in a program instruction execution. You might see the term abort that our textbook uses for the hardware was broken in some way. Or you might see that called a hard fault. You might see the term trap referring to a deliberately triggered exception. Or you might see those called faults. And the faults called exceptions. So the terminology is very inconsistent. This is why I'm going to avoid testing you on our textbook's terms. I'm going to use our textbook's terms, but I'm not going to like say, is this an interrupt or an exception, or interrupt or a trap? Because that I will think is an interesting question, because in the real world, that's not going to really help you understand anything. And also, this means that if you're like reading some documentation for something, and you see the term interrupt, you need to figure out what it really means, unfortunately. Like, it's some type of exception, but you need to figure out what they actually mean, whether it's all of them or one particular kind. So this is really annoying. Somewhat less annoying is that terminology for kernel mode is also inconsistent. Now, fortunately, it's usually pretty clear when they mean kernel mode. But sometimes you'll see terms like supervisor mode or privileged mode, or ring zero, where higher numbered rings are not kernel. And some systems have multiple levels of privilege. So like there will be some set of privilege operations that work at ring zero, some that work at ring one, and so on. Or some that will work in like supervisor mode, and some that will work in machine mode, you know, something like that. There will be some sets of multiple levels rather than just kernel and user mode, even though that's sort of the typical setup. Just some terminology notes. For kernel mode, at least, it's usually pretty clear when there's another term for it. It just might not be called kernel. For exception terms, yeah, you need to like check the definition if you're like reading a processor manual. So questions on terminology. Okay. So in our last five-ish minutes, I'm going to start talking about virtual memory. So I promised that we talk about how we actually implement this address space idea that we assign particular memory for. Yes, question? Our office hours going to be different next week? Yes, most likely we're just not going to hold office hours Wednesday on. And otherwise it'll be the same, but I should check with my TAs to make sure that that information is accurate in our TA meeting tomorrow. Other questions? Okay, so we're going to talk about virtual memory. So we mentioned this is how we actually implement this mapping that we talked about before. And we're going to choose one of these in our process switch. And a big question is, well, you know, how is this going to work? So first, some terminology stuff. So we're going to call the addresses that programs use, the ones that go into this mapping, virtual addresses. And note that every single address the program uses goes through this mapping. Function addresses, jump addresses, addresses of data, all go through this mapping. There are no exceptions. The program has no way of accessing something via the normal address. The addresses after the mapping, we're going to call physical. And something that this mapping can do is that the addresses on either side of the mapping could have different sizes. And in fact, pretty commonly, kind of will. And that's fine, because the mapping's going to change the size. So we're going to talk about, well, how do we store this mapping? Where do we store this mapping over the next several classes? And to start off with this, I'm going to give a toy example of a program with a very small memory. So our program here, our virtual addresses, the addresses the program sees, are 10 bits. And I'm going to divide up all my possible addresses into four pieces of equal size. And I'm going to call these pages. I'm going to number them from 0 up. And you'll notice, and something that is not a coincidence, that each of these pages is a power of 2 size, in this case 2 to the 8 bytes. And that's because having powers of 2 is going to be very convenient for this, just like having powers of 2 for our caches was very convenient. And because I've chosen this power of 2 size, I can get my index by looking at the upper bits of the address. And we'll call that index the page number. So question about this way of dividing up our memory into these pages. Yes? Why did I get 2 to the 8? So one reason is that I took 2 to the 10 and divided by 4 pages, and that's going to be 2 to the 8. Another way we could have figured out that it's 2 to the 10, 2 to the 8 is because, you know, if I add 1 and 8 zeros, I get to the next page. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. So the question is, the heap would grow upwards and the stack would grow downwards? So if we were following the typical Unix model, yes. Question, would that be typical for any memory design? That is the most common choice. Yes. Okay. So I mentioned these upper bits are called the page number. We'll have a name for the rest of the address, which we'll call the page offset. That's our location in our page. So the beginning of the page is 0. The end of the page is all 1s. Okay, so we have this way of dividing up our program's virtual map addresses, the addresses we can access. And we have to use this to help represent our mapping. That's what our original goal was. So question?
Where did you get 2 to the 10?
Where did they get 2 to the 10? Our addresses are 10 bits. So that's where 2 to the 10 came from. So we divide up our 2 to the 10 addresses into these pages. We're going to use that to help us make a mapping. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, OK, I have some my virtual addresses divided up into these 4 pages. And I'm going to divide up my physical addresses, the real memory addresses, into chunks of the same size. So in this case, my physical memory is bigger. It could be smaller, it could be bigger. Both happen on real machines. And I'm going to divide that up into a bunch of physical pages, which I'm going to number in the same kind of way. And just like with my virtual pages, you know, I can look at the upper bits of the address to determine the number. And these are the same size. And I'm just going to assign some of my virtual pages to specific physical pages, just all at once. Now, I've sort of drawn this as a picture. We unfortunately can't have our OS send the processor a picture. So we need to have some way of representing this that the processor can understand. And we're going to make a table called the page table. And this table is going to have an entry for every virtual page of what physical page number to use. And also the possibility of none, like trigger an error, is going to be needed. Okay, so this is our page table. Yes?
So there's a difference in size between the virtual memory and the physical memory. That's only expressed in the page numbers?
So the question is, the difference in size occurs with different size page numbers? Yes. The page offset sizes are always going to be the same. So once we have this table, well, we're going to have to represent it in a real way. So one thing, just like with caches, we needed an extra bit to represent nothing's here. We're going to have an extra valid bit in our page tables to represent cases where there's nothing there, where we should trigger an error. And we're going to do a lookup, which is going to look kind of similar to our cache lookup as far as, you know, getting the right entry. But then we're just going to use that to perform the correct address. So I get my address from the program. I'm going to divide it up into my page offset in green here and my page number. I'm going to look up the row of the table corresponding to the page number. I'm going to get my valid bit. If it's 1, I'm going to say that's okay. If it's 0, then the program accesses one of those trigger error regions of memory, and I'm going to cause an exception. Then I'm going to use my physical page number. I'm going to concatenate that with the original page offset. And that's my translation. And in this process, we call the entry, each row of this table, a page table entry. So we're looking up the page table entry and using that to translate our virtual page number to our physical page number while keeping the page offset the same. And that's where we'll leave off today. Yes? So the question, and final, will the final be timed? Yes, we have 3 hours.
Yeah.
Question is, where are we taking the final? Yeah. You are taking the final in Murray 209, 104, or 115.
Will it be on paper?
Yeah, is it like
on paper.
Okay.
Yes.